Welcome back to the Berlin Security Beat, brought to you by the Center for International Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. I'm your host, David Bukowski. This is episode 6 of our second season, where we explore how international security professionals translate theory into practice. Today, our focus is on the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. We are incredibly lucky to have with us today Vlasta Zekulic, currently serving as the branch head of strategic issues and engagements at NATO's Allied Command Transformation. Vlasta transitioned to NATO in 2017 after an extensive career in the Croatian military, where she attained the rank of lieutenant colonel. Her work at NATO has centered around creating and implementing strategic assessments and policies that directly influence the alliance's defense posture and crisis management capabilities. Vlasta was also the lead on a recent NATO model event that we co-organized at the Hertie School with our students this spring. We will cover a truly wide range of issues on the podcast today. Vlasta will speak about what it takes to work for NATO, share some amazing professional stories, and most importantly, provide essential advice on how to navigate a career at the organization. Vlasta, it's good to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
The core message of our season this year is to understand how practitioners develop their careers, how they move from theory to practice. Could we please begin by you outlining your career trajectory for our listeners?
So I think I was pretty lucky because from the beginning, my theory and practice aligned. First, I joined the police academy already, police college, in 1996, because Croatia, right after our war, did not have a military academy. And I always knew I want to carry weapons, uniforms, chase the bad guys away. So I had a quite clear path where I want to go. But since without military academy, I'm like, okay, police college will do. However, 2 years into my studies, Croatia started sending military cadets, basically selected cadets to the military academies worldwide. So I was one of the candidates, got selected, and then sent to the United States, where I finished military academy for 4 years later. So when I came back, so my education already was heavily influenced by the work I'm going to be doing for the rest of my career. However, those are the basic, I would say, like military skills or investigative skills. And my civilian major was computer science and management information systems. So my civilian degree at the military academy was a little bit decoupled from what will become the job I do now 25 years later. And I think what that school particularly gave me was ability to understand how algorithms work. And the understanding of what the algorithms work is basically how does the world around us happen? How are the data points setting up? What do I need to, what if, how, and, or, like, hold that mindset of the computer system is actually extremely useful in the job that I'll be doing for the rest of my life. However, the second part, after I came back home, joined the Croatian military, I was commissioned as a military officer. 8 months later, I was already deployed to Afghanistan. And for me, as a commander of the Croatian unit, and that was during the first presidential elections in Afghanistan in 2004. And for me to understand, okay, I'm here securing these elections, but what does it mean? I was never a type of person who could be satisfied, well, I'm here, I'm going to do my patrols for 6 months, and that's going to be it. I needed to understand. So in parallel, I started doing my master's in international relations and national security. So as I was researching the theory of security systems, how national security systems are being built and working, I was actually creating one in Afghanistan, being part of that system. And that's how I kind of, from that moment on, coupled most of my academic research. I continued after my master's with my PhD. Later on, I got to more executive type of master's. But I was always looking how my school can help me understand better what I do.
Wow, that's amazing. And to have the option to do theory and practice at the same time, that is a very privileged position to be in, and it must have been really fascinating.
It was sometimes very frustrating as well, but also very gratifying that you don't just depend on books, that you can actually, you know, see it in real and add fidelity to your academic research that otherwise you'd not be able to.
Right. I want to backtrack a little with a follow-up question. You did your computer science degree at the Citadel in South Carolina, right? Which I believe is quite an interesting military educational hotspot, if I'm not wrong. I was wondering what that was like.
Yes, and in 1998, when I joined, I was the second class of females in the school ever in 140 years because we're all male school until the Supreme Court of USA forced them in 1996 to accept females. And let's say that the boys did not take it lightly. I didn't know this when Croatia selected me. I don't know that American actually politicians and military peak that work on this international military affairs actually asked for me to be transferred down there. So studying was easy. You go through national selection process out of thousands of candidates, you're one of the five that's selected. So physically you're strong, you know that you're smart, you know English is good. And then you come to this old mean southern school where, profanities are abundant and there's just pure hatred because you are of the different gender. And it's nothing personal, it's just what you represent. And the first year was very difficult because you just have to endure it. There is no going back, you just have to live through it. They were particularly mad when me as a female and foreigner had like a 4.0 GPA, it's basically straight excellent grades, like first semester. They were very, very unhappy about that. Because like if the foreign girl can do it, what's wrong with American boys? Like it's kind of like gives you that very skewed mirror that they hated. But actually I found it harder on the second year. First year, you just have to suck it up and live through it. Second year, you're actually allowed to speak up. And this is where you actually start fighting to be seen as the individual, not part of like, oh, you're female. Like, no, I'm Vlasta and I'm Croatian and I'm this and I'm that. And you can actually speak up and fight. So I would find emotionally that because you still have to go through all the military training, through all the academics, but you have to fight to be seen as the individual. And that was my sophomore year. Once I won that battle, junior and senior year were easy. I was the drill sergeant, I was then battalion XO. I got on the who is who among the, students in the United States. I got every award imaginable. So, but that fight to be seen, to be like recognized as the individual, not, just slap labeled with something that was difficult. But it's also type of a school that forces you to think how to solve the problems. Nothing is given to you in that place. Nothing is guaranteed. Like find a way, fight for yourself. And I think that's actually quite a healthy mindset in the life that follows. Nothing worth having comes easy. So, fight for it, find a way through it. So it was quite brutal, but I'm forever grateful for the skill set, knowledge, and resilience that it gave me. So
I'm curious about your opinion from your experience. What do you think that professionals coming into the security field, what do you think that theory and their education does not prepare them for, particularly young professionals that you see entering NATO?
I would say they are not aware how messy it is. The real world, it's not nice, clean, and organized. It's not black and white. It's messy. It's complicated. It's complex. It's full of politics. And politics are determined by different groups, different nations, different positions. And they shift on one thing. You might be fully aligned with this group of nations on the other. It's nothing is clean and nothing is, nice, clear cut, what is good, what is bad, what is worth it, what it's not. It's not shared by a lot of the nations or a lot of the groups. So you have to constantly manage, like unpack these, like I say, complex situations, in complex environments, different national positions. So like I say, the pure messiness of it and how unpredictable it can be is something I think surprises a lot. The second part is I think it's like instinctive to all the young people. They're naive. They believe that everything is about like shared common good. Like there is at least some things that everybody come together and it's a kumbaya moment. And it's not like that. And this complexity of decision making and how decision making calculus work, because it is calculus. There is like national position A plus the regional position B plus the individual politician in charge position C plus something that somebody owes you D times some unknown X's gives you like, it's a complicated calculuses like equations that nations go through to make up their mind about a specific topic. And you, as a staff officer working in that environment, you will never know all of it. You will understand some of the positions, but there is always something that can surprise you. And then you can be at the table, like, where is this coming from? And like I say, it's not clean. It's not easy. It's not black and white. Like I say, it's messy. It's a lot of grays. It's very complicated. It's very political. There is always something, you know, nations usually hold, and I'm talking now from the NATO, like there's some like secret ace in the sleeve they will pull out in order to get something. So I think this is something that, you know, schools don't necessarily teach you.
Right. There's a lot of tacit and implicit knowledge that you cannot learn until you are in the environment, both bureaucratic and political. I wanted to ask you if you could share any other situations or stories, particularly in your later career, that have challenged you both personally and professionally.
Yeah, I mean, let me give you two. One from my military life, because it's more operational and it's therefore more personal. And then one from my NATO headquarters life, that's a little bit more on the professional side. So from the ISAF days, because I was deployed there in 2003 and 4 at the very beginning, you know, we are just building this new mission. It's full of hope and optimism. And we are so like passionate about what we are doing. Like it's a clean slate. You know, we could have built everything. And being there that early in the process, in the mission, was just amazing. Like, and I really enjoyed my job of my unit, what we've done for them, their potential and stuff like that. And then I had a short visit there in 2009 just to set up the mission Poli Kumri. That was, I already seeing like something is not right here. And then in 2012 to 13, when I deployed again, almost 10 years later, I was fundamentally disappointed by the progress that we have made on the systematic level. So we trained a lot of individuals. We did a lot of tactical level moves. The soldiers, NATO soldiers deployed there, they did great jobs of training the troops and giving them their knowledge, but it was all 6 months and 6 months and six. It wasn't adding up to anything. It was just perpetual a hedgehog day, you know, like it's kind of, and I could see that we are not making that the big fundamental difference, that shift where they actually bought into our mindset, our values, our way of training. Like they're doing it because we're paying them to do it. Like, let's put it like that. We give them paycheck. They do for 6 months what we want them to do, and then they move on and do something else. But fundamental change was not there. And that was the moment when the ISAF was switching to the resolute support. And we basically got orders one day to say like, okay, this mission is done. You have to write the reports that everything is done, standard achieved, and we are closing. I'm like, no, like it wasn't, it's not done. Like, but orders were orders and they were not illegal. So we basically had to comply, pack everything up, write it. And so I was so frustrated and angry as a professional. And of course I couldn't express it in my military life. And therefore I put up my academic hat and as the doctor's college then wrote like article, ISAF what went wrong, where I kind of could academically, and again, we talk about that merging theory and practice. I could actually say 10 years later, this is where our theory went wrong. This is where our practice basically failed to implement, well, not that good of a strategy, but like what I couldn't say or do as a soldier, I could say and do and express my opinions as the academic. And I found that also, if nothing else, at least conceptualizing that viewpoint, we should have done better here. And then you fast forward like almost 10 years later and we saw how the country collapsed. So, you know, but already, and it wasn't just me writing, I was just one of the little pawns who was like, what the hell is happening here? But it was very personal to me because, you know, when you're a young officer, 26, deployed for the very first time and you see potential and suddenly it's like, really? This is what we've done in a day? That was bad. But example where it was more professionally, like in a way that particularly when I transitioned from the military to political world, to the civilian world, and now you have to be playing the political, the civilian, international roles. There was the project that I was asked to kind of consider. NATO was using a lot of civilian, non-military experts to deliver different capacity building programs. And it wasn't really well organized, mapped. And I got a task like, figure this thing out. Who is there? What are they doing? Like, does this make any sense? Anything? So I digged it out and I found out it was truly like a very, very messy situation. Nobody was tracking. We don't know where the resources are going. We kind of completely lost the view of the scale of the program, and there was no way to map it or to manage it. So instead of trying, and again, me being practical military soldier, instead of trying to reinvent the new wheel, I dug out the older program that exists to manage this civilian experts. And I'm like, well, let's just, you know, dust it off, modernize it, digitize it, and we have the new tool. And it was called COMPASS. It's the acronym for comprehensive approach to like the civilian experts. So I do this, nations love it. I get 29 nations in the room. Everybody's, this is it, this is it, this is great. You know, this is exactly what we're looking for. Everybody except one nation. And, you know, it was the document that created this initial program. It was called the COMPASS policy. So the document that I wrote was updating or modernizing the COMPASS policy. And this is the language we used. And like I said, everybody loves it except this one nation. And they won't tell me what's wrong with it. They're like, no, you know, we cannot agree. We cannot. I'm like, and I'm getting so frustrated. And I'm like, what's wrong? Like, just talk to me. So finally I got, and I was new, so I don't really know how all of this works. So finally I take my, like, you know, instinct. I grab this like counselor at the table. I'm like, we need to have a coffee. I'm like, off limits, chat, just what's wrong with it? And this lady tells me like, how are you committed to the word policy in this document? And I'm like, I'm not committed to the word at all. It's just what initial document was called. It's like, well, my capital forbid me to change any NATO policies. So she's like, if we love the proposal, but we can't allow the change of policy. So if you would call it something else by the policy, I could agree to it. Like, I'm like, yeah, like, what word do you want? She's like, how about mechanism? I was like, mechanism it is. Control, fine, through the text, next session, all hands go up. So it shows you how sometimes, like, again, it's not about the solution. It's not about how good or bad you are. It's about, you know, finding why certain nations have a certain reservation for it. And this was like so eye-opening for me. Like, and if I didn't kind of, if I stayed in my corner the way I'm supposed to and not reached out and tried to work it and negotiate it and build a rapport, the great proposal to fixing a big problem could not be accepted.
Those are very good examples and case studies for our listeners to consider. Could you speak more about core skills that you think are necessary for a range of different roles in NATO? I mean, could you outline the skills that you see as absolutely essential?
So the first thing I will always say is the knowledge. I've seen it a lot lately that a lot of young people, they learn to pass exam. They don't learn to know, because the information is readily available. It's always in your phone and somewhere. But when you're in the meeting room, you can't pull your phone and say, like, let me Google that. Like, you need to know things. And this core knowledge, core capacity that on any given moment you can whip from your brain and your mouth, like, information that's needed, it's quite rare. It's quite rare nowadays. So I will always say, know your thing. Don't learn to pass the exam, learn to know. Connect your knowledge, like, build it up. And the more things you can connect, the easier it's going to be to manage and use your knowledge, you know, from one field in another. So, because what knowledge gives you is trust. If people, particularly your bosses and managers at the table, when you open the mouth and they know this is the right information, that's built trust. Whether they like it or not, they will trust you. So knowledge is direct linked to the trust that you will get a job. Second thing is, like, language matters. And I see a lot of young people, because everybody's super fluent in English, they're very fluffy. They put a lot of words which don't add up to anything. So they try to overcompensate the lack of knowledge with the fluffiness of words. So there is a lot of things that come together, but I'm like, this means nothing. It's gibberish. Like, it sounds good. It's a good sounding gibberish, but it's still gibberish. So when I say language matter, it means, like, it has to be simple and to the point. It's not meant to be, it still has to be educated one. But it has to be pure. If you don't know the answer, you don't say it. But you don't use just the volume of words in order to camouflage the fact that you don't have any idea what's happening. And I've seen that coming more profoundly in the written documents. In the oral, they can still kind of, like, you can still manipulate it. But when you have to write it, it really does not come across right. So language matters. Keep it simple. Keep it clear. keep it like to the point, particularly if you're going to work in any of the military commands. And, you know, at the political levels, there is still a little bit space for ambiguity. In the military ones, there's not, you know, either, you know, this is it, like not. We could consider that a certain topic can be viewed from several different angles, which may or may not be perceived by the different, like, that type of a thing, like I say. So language matter, because, like I say, clarity is important. The third thing I would say is creativity. And this is where I think we make a lot of mistakes when we take young people in. We're like, this is how you do things. And we kind of, you know, pigeonhole them, like, this is how things are and stuff. But I think we are, where it's very important that young people keep on surprising us by seeing the solutions behind or beyond what we know there are solutions. So again, the schools, the more schools you finish, the older you get, you will be a little bit more, well, this is how I do this, this is how I do this, but can you do stuff differently? So ability to keep some part of your brain or personality or whatever, like creative, innovative, open, surprising, you know, everybody will accept it. Everybody will need it. They will be surprised by it, but they will be like, oh, maybe there is something there. If our young people just echo exactly the same thing I say all the time, you know, well, I'm bringing somebody 20 years younger to tell me stuff that I don't know, you know, or that see things differently. I don't need more of what I already know, in a way. So I think this part of creativity, creative thinking, ideating, thinking beyond the obvious, like that we kind of told them, is something that's very important.
Knowing your brief has definitely come up in this podcast before. I would like to zoom in on the day-to-day life at NATO now. Could you outline what your day is like at NATO? What is the schedule, the operational environment, and what can people expect?
So, I mean, it's every team is a bit different. If you're a concept development person, you will probably come and get your paper and they say like, okay, in 6 months, I need to see like 30-page paper on this topic. So it's a very much singular, you know, you sit, you research, you write, it's different. If you are in my team, we're extremely close-knit, working as a, in a little like hubs and stuff. So at any given time, I have about 10 projects running and my little teams are out there doing their bits and then pushing all towards me. So it's very much, like I say, depends. If you're working very close to our four stars or generals in their front offices, you will be a lot of like catering to a single guy, you know, like guy or a girl, you know, you will be working for them, writing speeches for them, like interacting daily, figuring out how they want it, what they want it, what they need to know, when they want it. So I would really not say there is a one shoe kind of like a fit all, or it's very individual. But one thing that it's always, I think, true, no matter where you are, there are most of the bosses, and I work like in international military staff, international staff, here at the military command, at ACT, bosses need two things, all of them. First, at the beginning of your, when they give you a task, you take it, you kind of like look into it, and then you come very early in the process to do so-called sanity check. Like, am I getting this right? Is this type of information that you want? So keep your bosses involved early in, just to see if you go way too far with your work, and then you show it to your boss and you're like, actually, this is not it. You know, you wasted your time and his or her time. So get the task, break it down, do the initial work. But before you actually commit the main part, do the sanity check with your boss. Do that touch point that sounds like, does this sound about right? That's one moment that's super crucial and vital in every project. And then I would, what I call that, give again your boss like 70% solution. Bosses will always have opinions on it, whether it's a style, whether it's a, like, because they know more than any individual. No, even I have two deputies, no matter how many emails I CC them on them, I still know more just because of the exposure that I get. So 70% solution is perfectly fine. Bosses will then go through it, clean it, check it up, add, remove, shift stuff, ask you to add something, ask you to remove something, and then you march on to the final thing. So those are like two, I would say, the most important, and there could be more touch points along the way, but those two are super important. Initial sanity check and then 70% solution. And then you're going to go for the final stride. If you miss one of these two, you are risking getting a lot of time spent, a lot of effort spent, and then it might be completely had to be rewritten. I had few situations, not in my team, but in the surrounding branches here, and I see how frustrating it is for them, the staff officers, because they feel they're not valued. They feel like their work, like, but it's not. It's really not personal. It's just what you as individual thought that this is the right way forward, you know, might not be what your boss has in mind. And also there's a little shift in it. When you're working down the project, you can be taken down one line almost inadvertently, you know, like you kind of like one thing feeds another and suddenly you're way deep in, or just like, you know, 5 degrees off, and you would be right on the right place. But the further you go, further you are from the goal. Another thing that can also influence a lot of young people, like in general, like staff officer, is when are like a 4 stars in this case, or 2 or 3 stars, like our generals, they change their mind. You know, they thought they wanted to go this way. And then it comes out, well, actually, I needed to go that way. And again, people, when they commit their time and effort, they start taking their work personally. And it's not personal. It's not personal. Even if somebody says, like, this is not it, start from scratch. I had colleagues in international staff, like, literally get emotional breakdowns, crying for days. I mean, it's like, it's not personal. It's not that they don't like you. It's just at this point, this paper does not fit national agendas. But it's hard, particularly if you don't have this bouncing back and forth, like checks along the way, spending like a month working on a paper, giving it in, this is it, final, done, sealed. And they're like, yeah, well, you know, it can definitely create a very negative effect in a team. So sanity check, 70%, those are minimum that you should go, and then go for the final stride and be open to the ideas. Even if somebody writes you like, we hate this because 1, 2, 3, you are like, well, okay, I hear you. You can see if there is the need to adjust, or at least to defend against somebody else who is thinking that. So inviting as many comments as you can, good, bad, and the ugly, are all very useful. Like I say, you don't have to take them into account, but you have to hear them and be open to hearing them. And I think that's one thing that I've seen emotionally harms a lot of people, creates them to be disappointed, and they shouldn't. Like I say, we just had like grown-up colleague here also quit because she's like, well, I can't get my point across. Like, my superior did not approve my travels, so he hates me. I'm like, no, you're just in this moment in time, you're not a priority. But for her, it's personal and it shouldn't be. So I think this is what young people particularly have to guard against. It's never personal. It's just how the system works. And sometimes you'll hit the nail on the head and sometimes you won't.
Thank you so much. You led the NATO model event at the Hurdy School this spring, and you also ran a mentoring session. I remember making a note of something you said. You stated that, especially with junior staff who comes into NATO, they're expected to leave after a period of time, go into the private sector, into consulting or the defense industry, and then come back and bring more value back to the alliance. So I was wondering if you could clarify and elaborate on this statement.
So that will always be my recommendation, because you're only as relevant as your knowledge is relevant. So when you're young and bright and you're coming out of college, you're full of the latest, newest, hottest academic stuff. You're in your most likely early to mid 20s. You know, you will bring fresh blood to the organization. You will bring fresh knowledge, and we need you at that point. But then if from that moment you actually stay in for another 40 years until you're 65, like, that's still the only thing you know. You might get experience in doing things, but you haven't, because NATO is not type of organization that invests a lot in people's training, education. You can't get promoted in the jobs. You actually have to apply. So it's not somebody who will, it's not an organization that will foster you to grow as a person. We just need you to work. So that's why I said, if you spend like, you know, 3-4 years with us in this like initial stages of your career, like, so you kind of build it you know it, you apply your initial knowledge, you see what the organization is like, you see, you meet different teams, organizations, the whole NATO enterprise. You kind of profile what you like better. Do you like policy work? Do you like engagement space? Do you like technical parts? Do you like contracting? Like, you find within the NATO universe what is most you like. Then I would always say, go out, use our name, because NATO is a very strong brand. Like, I work for NATO, but now I need to, you know, apply for a different job, get additional knowledge and expertise in the space that you like, you know, like that you identify from being inside as your more, you know, your priority, like, or your future orientation. Spend like 3, 4, 5 years there, and then, like I say, come back in your 30s or 40s. If you want to have a leadership role in NATO, national experience is super important, you know, because, like, so if you want to climb up the management level, you need some sort of connection with your national home governments in defense, in security, like the foreign affairs, something like that. If you want to be recognized as the expert in one of the areas, you need the companies that actually do that for a living, whether it's AI or data or energy or climate or hybrid or communications. I mean, that is what I'm saying. Like, come in, meet us, get to know us, you know, inject your fresh blood into us, find exactly what you like about NATO the most, step out, become an expert in it, and then come back and rule.
Yes, that sounds like very reasonable advice. My last question is one I ask all our guests, and that is, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Keep calm and carry on. Well, I'm not the calm, but it's one thing actually that Citadel, the military academy I did, taught me early on. And I would always tell myself the same thing. In order, there are good days, there are bad days, there are stuff. But if you have in front of yourself your long-term goal, your midterm goal, and your short-term goal, they force us to just survive the first year. They would ask us, what's your goal for this week, for this month, for this trimester? And we had to put it on our doors. But the fact that you break your, this is where I want to get. This is what I want. So what are the steps I need to do to get there? It puts your mind into this like a planning step-by-step mode. And that truly helped, like most of us, survive through that year and through the most difficult parts of my life. So I would always say, there was this, I don't know who said it, but like, it says that obstacles are all those horrible things you see when you take your eyes off the goal. So keep the eyes on the goal. And even if you have to step left or right on that path, you still know where you're going. So I think that is the most vital part of advice I would give to myself and anybody else. Know what your goal is. It at the beginning is going to be finish the college, get the job, like, and then when you reach that point, immediately set yourself another goal and then go towards that goal. Because like I say, like that, you always know where you're heading, even if you have to step away. But if you have no idea what the horizon is, what's the point, then every day is kind of like lost day in a way. You're just wandering there, hoping the life will happen to you. And I'm not that type of a person. I think a lot of young people are not either. Set a goal, keep an eye on that goal, and march on. Good and bad. Like I say, sometimes it's going to go slow, sometimes it's going to go running, but that's something I think it really, really works. It really helps.
Well, thank you so much, Vlasta Zakulic.
Truly my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Best of luck to you with the podcast and your students in studying. And I do hope to see you all with more of NATO Model events in the future iterations of the Harte School. It was truly a pleasure to be there.
And that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for all our listeners for tuning in. As always, please subscribe and follow the Center for International Security on X, formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, for more of our content, research, events. And we'll be back next month with a new limited series project. From Berlin, this is David Bukowski.